Welcome to the Brad and Body Podcast. You already know who we are. We wouldn't be here, so let's not waste any more time. Here's Bradley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Brad and Body Podcast. Body, it's great to have you, eh? How are you?
I'm really good, and I'm so glad that, unlike last week, this week people were back to being unable to see us. They could just have the audio. Last week, the visual, gee, that was scary, wasn't it?
Yes, we've been having a lot of messages that Brad and Body have great heads for radio. So,
Perfect.
So this is fantastic. But look, we are back. That was fun last week, Body. I did enjoy it. We got some fantastic views and raves on about. We may look to do that again. But yeah, let me just say, I am no Joey Wright. So anyway, but this one, we've got a Where Are They Now, and it's someone we've been looking very much forward to having. I played against this man a lot of times, and I'd love to say I enjoyed it, but I didn't because he beat us all the time. But that's anyway, we'll come back to that. And let's start. Born and raised in Coaldale, New South Wales, which is about 11 minutes north of Wollongong. He started his NBL career in 87, playing for the mighty Illawarra Hawks. And then in 1989, and what we all really know him as, he signed for the Melbourne Tigers. He went on to play 449 games in the NBL, an astonishing achievement. In that time, he is a two-time NBL champion with the Tigers in 93 and 97. And who can ever forget that Perth game in 93 with Lindsay and Andrew cuddling each other?
Yeah, his iconic singlet, moment.
Absolutely. And now this is the huge one. His mighty number six singlet is retired. And that just tells you how good this guy is. The basketball, well, it runs in his family, as we obviously all know. Josh, who did play in the NBL last year for the mighty Adelaide 36ers, Body, is now tearing it up as the sixth pick for the Oklahoma City. And what a year he's having. He was the sixth pick, obviously, in last year's draft. And not only that, his daughter, Hannah, plays college basketball for the Oral Roberts Golden Eagles, which is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just down the road from where Josh is. I've had the pleasure, as I said, to play many games against this man, but I didn't like him because he bloody beat us all the time. But when you think of the surname Giddy right now, of course, you'd probably think of Josh. But let me tell you, this man was an unbelievable player in the NBL. You don't play 449 games with two championships for no reason. I am delighted to say that we are joined on Where Are They Now? And none other than Warwick Wazza Giddy. Wazza, how are you, mate?
Oh, great. That sounded like a bloody eulogy there, Brad. And thank you very much. It's a very impressive introduction, and great to be on the show with you guys.
You realise you're the first, and then Damian Martin was probably the second player that was able to influence games without scoring, without that being a primary, you know, like defence, rebounds, setting screens, getting people open. You know, the Damian Martin, we all know he's the defensive specialist, wasn't really reliable as a scorer and didn't need to be. But you were actually probably the blueprint, Warwick.
Yeah, look, it's funny. It's not that I didn't want to score or didn't like scoring. It was just something that I wasn't naturally good at. And, I scored all through my career as a junior. Obviously, when you're bigger and stronger than everyone, you can get close to the basket and it's a lot easier to score there. But when you get against grown men, and so I used to play and think, how can I contribute in other ways if I'm not going to be a fantastic scorer? And, you know, it was probably from a footy background where I wasn't sure how to dive on a loose ball or set the screen and do the little things. And, you know, the irony is now is when I coach young kids, I say, don't base your game on scoring. There's so much more to the game than putting the ball in the hoop. And, you know, some do it better than others. And as I said, maybe if I'd shot the three-pointer well, I wouldn't have dived on the loose ball.
I'm gonna go straight to something that always intrigued me, but then I want to go back to your junior career and where it all started. But the first thing is, I know when I was playing with the Sydney Kings, the scout was always like, you know, stop Andrew Gaze, stop Copeland, and you'll go a long way to winning. But then we did that in one game and you had like 28 points, 12 rebounds and 10 assists or whatever it was. Did you know coming into those games, you know, the target's going to be on there, or did you just, nah, we're staying in this shuffle. We know that if it happens and I can shoot it, I can. How was the mindset with you?
Yeah, look, it was always a pass-first mindset, and it was funny. Different teams tried different tactics. Some teams would pressure the hell out of me, try and be all over, and other teams would stand off and try and fill the gaps. And we always felt when they stood off, it was a bit easier to pass. You know, it's like an uncontested drill at training. If you have four on four and the fifth bloke's got no one on him, it's very easy to just pick blokes off. And, you know, I found it was really easy when people stood off me. Obviously, when they got up and pressured me, they were a bit worried about me driving by them, which was more to my strength. So different teams tried different tactics. But, yeah, we stayed solid to the shuffle. You know, obviously my primary function was to try and get blokes open and set good screens and really continue the structure and maybe go and get some offensive rebounds. But yeah, pretty, you know, I was going in with the mindset of a pass first and, you know, probably wasn't looking to shoot. And, you know, something in hindsight, I look back and think, you know, I probably should have shot a lot more 8 to 10 footers, which, you know, I was probably more than capable of knocking down.
Nah, you did all right, mate. You did all right. Don't worry.
49 games. Jeez.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Warwick, the question we always like to start early in these interviews with our guests is, how did you come to basketball? Like, you're a New South Wales boy to start with, so I'm thinking, yeah, you're a solid kid, maybe rugby league as you're calling. How did you come to basketball? Was it a family thing, a friend thing? How did you discover the sport? And take us through that little part, early part of your journey.
Yeah, look, I was involved in surf life saving, rugby league heavily. And when I was in sixth class at East Corrimal Primary School, a teacher was right into basketball. And now we didn't have basketball courts. There was a netball court with netball lines, no backboards or anything. And because I was the tallest in the class and I was playing rugby league, he sort of grabbed me and said, you know, do you want to learn about this game of basketball? And he sort of took me under his wing. I was reasonably athletic and I went and tried out for the South Coast regional side that year and got picked. Surprisingly enough, you know, I couldn't even do a layup with the correct footwork. And I was just this kid, mad kid, running frantically around the court, you know, running and hustling. And they saw enough to give me an opportunity. Unfortunately, the best kid in the side was having an operation for his appendix and came back in, and I was the worst kid and got cut. But then I went to the parents actually moved to from Colcliffe, where I grew up, to North Wollongong. And a bloke called Ted Weston, who coached the Illawarra Hawks, was the under-14s Illawarra coach. And I was lucky enough to make the Illawarra one side, and I was the worst player by a mile, but I had the best team in the state. And I learnt really quickly, and fortunately enough, grew by under-16s and sort of just kept progressing from there.
Were you always a big scorer at junior level? So, I mean, I know you said you weren't at the start, but as you started to get better, make the ones and then go through these things, was it the big scorer and you dominate?
Yeah, look, you know, especially in youth league and under-18s and under-20s, maybe with state sides. I would score reasonably freely. Now, it wasn't through jump shots. It was more taking blokes off the dribble, getting offensive rebounds and working in around the paint. So it was never like I was pulling up for threes in my junior career. That never happened. And, you know, I'd make free throws, get fouled a lot. So scoring wasn't an issue. But as I said, it wasn't through jump shots. And as you got to the big league, bigger bodies, more athleticism, it was obviously a lot harder to score inside. So, yeah, it was quite capable back in the day. But as I said, never through jump shots.
Okay, now I'm racking my brain, and it's, as I get older, this is harder to do. But were you at the Institute? Was the Institute going at that time? Right, so you got picked up to the Institute and then sort of from AAS to Illawarra?
Yeah. So in my last year of school, I came back from the schoolboys rugby tour, and I think that came back on January 30th, and I was supposed to go in the next day to the Institute of Sport for basketball. So I dropped rugby league and rugby union, which I've been playing, you know, pretty at a high level till then, and decided to concentrate on basketball. So I was lucky they gave me 2 weeks off, which is the worst 2 weeks you'd ever want to come to the Institute, where they run all the fitness drills and they really came with the 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate. I was back with my mate in Wollongong having a good time and came down there. So I did that in 1986. Mark Bradkey, Marty Clark was there. I'm just trying to think. Shane Trolling. So it's a lot of those guys that ended up, and we all played together in 1987 with the Australian under-21 side at the World Championships.
So how did it come about then? You finished 86 and you're now at the Institute, and was it you just wanted to go to Illawarra because that's where you were from? Did you have other offers? How did that work?
No, look, I was always keen to go back to Wollongong. I never really wanted to go to the Institute. I sort of felt like I had to go there if I wanted to make that Australian junior side. And,
interesting.
You know, I was the most reluctant of participants to go, but by the time I had to get out of there, I really liked the place and wanted to stay. Had some great mates there, and by that time I'd left it too late. So Pat Hunt sort of said, no, mate, you go on. We've already filled your spot. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to have Illawarra and get a job there. And, you know, stayed there for 2 years with Dave Lindstrom as the coach. But unfortunately, I just didn't see it eye to eye with him. You know, I respected him as a coach. I thought he was, you know, his tactics were really good and everything. But personally, I just didn't get on with him. Yeah, we were on different lines in our walks of life.
Okay, so that was my next question, and that happens. We've all had those coaches, no question. And Boddy and I pretty much have it to each other each day that we do this podcast.
Yeah, but can't do this anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But when you're now saying, right, I wanted to leave Illawarra, how did that come about? Did you have an agent, or was it just, you know,
no,
back then it wasn't huge then, you know what I mean? So what was it like?
Yeah. Not at all. There was an import, Gary Gaspard, who you may be familiar with, and he was our import at Wollongong, and he left also at the same time and headed to Melbourne. And he really ran into Lindsay. He was training with the Tigers and said, there's a young kid in Wollongong that you should have a look at. And they really brought me down for I think it was about 2 weeks of training before they went over to America. And Lindsay obviously saw enough, said, yep, you can come on the American tour with us. We'll trial you out. And that was the year that Andrew was at Seton Hall in 89. So have him on that tour. And at the end of the tour, they said, yep, we'd love to have you, and offer me a contract. So really, you know, beggars can't be choosers. It wasn't like anyone was knocking the door down. I think Canberra was half interested because of my time at the Institute, and Phil Smythe was the coach there. But, you know, it sort of was one of those things where I made the big leap of faith, and I didn't know much about Melbourne, didn't realise it was on the coast, thought it was a lot more inland, and, you know, the rest is history. I came down and I haven't left.
Okay, yeah. I'll go on. You go, buddy.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so if Andrew wasn't there when you got there, when did you sort of settle into the role thinking, okay, I'm better off setting screens, getting guys open? Like when did he arrive? Like when you got there initially, were you filling the box score with points?
Yeah, look, I'd get 10 points, it's reasonably regularly. But, once again, it was the system and the shuffle. It was something I was trying to get my head around and learn from my spot in the way basketball was played by the Tigers. So it was a whole different setup and a whole different system. And my first year, Andrew came back in, I think just a little bit late, but we had Dave Colbert and Dave Simmons. And those three guys were averaging well over 90 points, I think, a night for us. And, the rest of us were really just role players. And, you know, as I tell people, you know, maybe some games we scored 14 to 16 points. And that was an absolute bonus for our guys, for the team, because generally the big three always scored 90. So although we were reliant on them, when others stepped up, the job was a lot easier.
I remember growing up, and I'd be at the Kingdom and I'd be watching you guys on 89 and like Dave Colbert, and then there was the head-butting incident with Tim Morrissey, and there was that. Can I ask, I'm trying to put my dates right, and Boddy, you may even be able to help me. There was a time there where the Melbourne Tigers would get beaten easily. Now, was that pre you getting there?
Yeah, look, that was from up to 88. In 89, that was the first year we made the playoffs, so... Dave Simmons, myself, Ray Gordon came back to the club. Dave Colbert joined, and also a young Brett Brown, I think, joined the organisation at the same year.
Okay.
And that was the first year that we made playoffs. And
right. So then you started to become regulars in the playoffs, as we know. Do you feel it's fair to say that probably when Copes came, it then turned that program into, right, we're going to win this? Or is that a bit unfair to Dave Colbert? And I'm not certainly meaning that in any bad way.
Yeah, look, definitely. Unfortunately, sort of Dave Colbert, who ran his time, you know, had a few arguments with management. You know, I don't think there was too much complaint with his ability to play the game.
Yeah.
And then Leonard came in, and that was 92. And when Leonard came in, he was just an amazing athlete. That probably changed our dynamic a bit.
Yeah.
And we made the grand final. We were happy as hell. I think we beat Sydney in game three up there unexpectedly. I think Sydney were the favourites that year, and we were just happy to get into the grand final. We were almost like we celebrated the win getting there.
It was 92, because I remember the whole of Sydney, because that was the first year Dean Utoff came up, Dwayne McLean was here, and it was like you guys, it was a Sunday afternoon, and it was in Sydney, and
it was absolutely
massive, and there was 10,500 people at the Kingdome, and this was the year the Kings are going to the grand final, and you guys came up and went.
Wait another decade.
That must have been amazing for you guys. That would have been one of the biggest wins.
Yeah, definitely. And another bloke that I did forget to mention was Robert Sibley, who came and joined in 92.
I got one for you too. And Mark Bradke.
Mark Bradke, 93. So Bradke always gives us the cope. You came and got us to the championship. I won it for you.
Won it for you. sounds like Bradke.
they're happy to argue that point. But yeah, Robert Sibley was a massive point piece. You know, he came in that 92, got us to the grand final. 93 obviously helped us to win it. But definitely Mark Bradke coming over was a major piece. And, I had to take a back step there for a couple of years with Robert joining us. And more than happy to do that to get the championship. And, you know, that was our first ever title in Perth.
Do you remember that Sunday game when it was Mark Brackey's first trip back to Adelaide, and the crowd, you know, after he'd left the 36ers, and the crowd just hounded him like I've never heard before or since. And we had our share of villains here in Adelaide, Shane Hill, Brian Gordon, but were you a part of that game when they just give it to Brack. Even from the moment he walked out.
Yeah, definitely. He was my roomie for most of my career there. And, you know, it's amazing that he handled it so well. You know, the pressure with people just constantly booing you every time you touch the ball in the game, you know, the pressure he must have felt. I think he did really well to either disguise it or to handle it. And it never really seemed to affect his performance out there. But I'm sure deep down, you know, if that's happening consistently, you know, it's going to get to you after a while.
Yeah, well, he had the little goatee as well, you know, the big black goatee. He came out looking like a villain. It's like he didn't play the role.
Yeah, definitely. And some players thrive on that, you know, Shane Hill. Yeah. You know, he thrived on people hating him, and, you know, the only way you could get him back was by a great performance. And I think you find that with a lot of sportsmen, if they're getting heckled or harassed, you know, their only answer is, okay, I'm going to put in a great performance here. So sometimes you can unleash the beast in them.
Yep. I can still remember Shane running down the middle of Adelaide with both fingers up on either side, telling everyone you can go and do this in Adelaide.
They lost. They lost. Just looking
of course. And we ran straight to the change rooms. Walser, I want to ask you, I don't know if this is a lot asked, but was it hard to play when there was just like Andrew Gaze is like the Michael Jordan, right? There's no question about that. And you watch, you know, the last dance of Michael Jordan and how players just sort of had to fit in. Was there any feeling like that where it's just like, this is hard?
Not really. You know, sometimes there can be jealousy with people, you know, about their roles in the teams. I was always, I suppose, conscientious of my ability. You know, as I said, you know, I was happy to fill that role. I thought that was going to give me longevity in the league. So just, you know, it was hard, I suppose, if you want that notoriety. For people, you know, especially in the NBA, it's ego-driven. So people like to look at their stats and have all these fancy numbers. So I suppose it could get hard for some players. It wasn't for me because I was all about winning. You know, if I had no points and we won, I was happy. If I had 10 points and we lost, I was disappointed. So in that sense, it was, you know, it was easy for me because I was a team player first and really just wanted team success. And if I had great players around me, that was going to be easier to achieve.
Yeah, and Andrew's sort of not that kind of mindset that Michael Jordan is, where, you know, everybody's got to come up to his level sort of thing. But I want to take you back 25 years to the 1997 championship. In 96, Melbourne Tigers played the South East Melbourne Magic, won the first game, and then Brian Goodgen, who was coaching the Magic at the time, went on record and said, we don't think we can beat these guys playing basketball, which I thought was a fascinating quote at the time. And then I watched them beat the living daylights out of you for the next two games and win the championship. So we roll around in 97. You win the first game. You drop the second game. And now we come to game three. Early in the piece, Sam McKinnon comes down the lane. You meet him. You let him know. You crack him and say, like, we're not going to take that kind of physical BS from you guys this time. I think you broke his nose. Was that obviously hitting him wasn't a calculated. You didn't want to break his nose. That wasn't a calculated thing. But certainly you were definitely looking like you wanted to send a message.
Yeah, look, I had bad memories from 96, and both times we won championships, the Magic beat us the year before in 92. And in 96, they gave us a flogging in that last game, and I just remembered it was almost like we were weak and mild at the end and gave up. And I got to game three in 97, and I said, not on my watch, that is definitely not going to happen again, and I'm going to do everything in my power, physically, you know, whatever I can do to help the team. And I remember that Sam incident. So I'd sort of stumbled out of court. You know, I was the last one running back, and I was sprinting down the right sideline. And I'm watching Sam coming down, and he's sort of a bit hesitant, thinking, well, who's picking me up? And not one of my teammates. And I ran along the baseline, and I saw him coming to dunk. And I think his biggest mistake was he cocked it back a little bit extra because he was going to give it some, and which just gave me that half a step to come up under the ring and meet him there on the dunk. And you know, I didn't even realise that I'd make contact with his nose. I thought he was just putting it on so Andrew Parkinson could come on and shoot the free throws. But little did I know they were over there. They were straightening up his nose. Parky took the free throws. He loved that fact. He was happy that I did it in that moment. But, that really put a dent in him, and I think a real dent in Sammy's confidence for the rest of that game.
And that's the thing that I loved about that era, and you just said it. I didn't know I hit him, but that was just how we played. It was hard. Yeah. And you know, there was old that, well, if you're going, especially in playoffs, if you're coming, well, you better bring it because we're coming to get you, and I love that. I want to transfer a little bit now to out of basketball. So you've retired now, and I know you've done a lot of coaching, and I want to talk about that. Yeah. But my mindset is you've got two amazing kids that are playing basketball. We're not here to talk about Josh. This is about you, and we know what happens with Josh. But I want to know, as a parent growing up, where's that fine line of pushing and not pushing, and who do I coach and don't I coach?
Look, that was extremely difficult. I remember watching my oldest daughter, Hannah, when she first played in prep, and a young kid taught him. And I watched and I thought, well, I've got to do this for any of my kids. I'm going to get and coach them so I can give them the correct instruction early, teach them a layup at 6 or 7 years of age with the correct footwork, teach them how to dribble a basketball, introduce them to the fundamentals. So when Josh started, I took his group. They were all in prep, and I was lucky that I had a good bunch of sportsmen, sporting parents, and you know, we took that team to and won the state primary school championship 6 years later in year six. So it was tough because I was always heavy on Josh as a disciplinarian. He was better skilled because of the environment he was around, coming with me to Melbourne Tigers camps, Melbourne United camps, always having a basketball. So he was generally better than the other kids, and I was so conscientious about him not being a hog, about him including his teammates, pass first. You know, I'd tell him a two-on-one, if you come, draw the guy, give it to your mate. Now, if your mate can't catch it or can't put it in, that's not your problem. You've got to make that right decision. I said, as you get better and you get in better teams, that bloke will be able to catch it and make the basketball to the point where the NBA, you can just throw it anywhere and they'll carry it and dunk it. So I had an always heavy emphasis and was always conscientious about myself as a parent of the best kid in the team, and parents sort of saying, oh, you're giving him too much opportunity, you're playing more than other kids. And I was fortunate that most of my teams won through the shuffle system. We ran basically a rep basketball, so it was all inclusive. And, you know, there I didn't have to play Josh 40 minutes a game in rep. I was able to, you know, spread the time equally amongst my team because we were winning most years. So that I was always thankful for that, and having a good team, and I just didn't need to play Josh and flog the hell out of him.
I'm interested in hearing that, because when you're a parent and you've played the game and you sit there and you're watching your kid in under 10s and they've got some other junior girl coaching them, and you know that you're watching from the sideline and you're biting your tongue, because that's what we should be doing. You whinge from without, you change from within. And that's what sort of brought me back into coaching. I thought, well, I've got a coach, and I'm interested to hear, because Brad, you've got the same situation there, haven't you? You've got a son playing.
100%, a 10-year-old, or 11-year-old son. And my wife literally said word for word, put up or shut up. If you don't like how they're coached, step in and coach them.
And it's great that you say that, because I tell them, if my basketball mates are whinging about the coach, I said, we're more qualified than anyone. I said, get in. And that's the point I made. I wasn't going to sit there and criticise when I could do it. So I was like, I'll do it. You can criticise me if you want. But obviously coming through the background, you know, coming through Lindy Gaze's system for 15 years, I probably knew what I was talking about. And, you know, we run the shuffle with all my junior teams. I've got another. One's with the Melbourne Tigers and one's in the 16-2s as a bottom age. So I've coached both of those girls, and, you know, all my teams run the shuffle. But I have.
Can I just say, I got to laugh when you say that, because one of my best mates up here, and I know you play with him, or Stephen Whitehead, right? And Steve's up here, and all these Tigers boys, all they do is run the shuffle,
it's
mate.
All they know. It's all they know.
He's in Cranbrook, and he's like, right, I want you guys, you run the shuffle. And then he just, I just love it. I love hearing it.
Yeah, well, I think what it does, it teaches junior kids all aspects of the game. And, you know, it's funny. I watch Josh does a left-handed, one-handed backdoor pass to the NBA, and they're raving about it. And I'm saying to my mates, we run that drill with our under-12 girls. We're teaching them how to make one-handed backdoor passes. We teach them, if you can't beat your man one-on-one, how do you run a cut to get yourself open? How do you make that pass to that person making a cut? So it's the little skills, it's the little things that I don't think the game's evolved where it's just five out, one-on-one. And I say to kids, well, if you can't beat your man, you can't play the game. But not in my system. You'll be able to pass the ball, run a cut, run your man off the screen and get open, receive the ball and just have to make a layup uncontested. Yeah. So what we tell the juniors is, this is how the game can be run. As you get older and you get as good as James Harden, you can dribble the ball 50 times, pass it to no one and shoot the ball. I said, but not on my watch. You've got to earn that right. And so we play a team system where everyone's inclusive, and they learn how to play as a team rather than an individual.
Well, there's five on the floor. You know, it's not one, it's five. Yep. And I mean, that's the interesting thing, because Josh is going very well in the NBA. Probably we all expected that he would, but we're all surprised at how well he's doing so quickly. And that's because he does play all aspects of the game. Just give us an inkling, Warren, as to your level of pride in terms of what you see. I mean, you've got to just sit there and watch him sometimes and go, that's my boy.
Oh, immense pride, you know. And sometimes, you know, I'm squirming and almost embarrassed at the praise they give him. You know, I feel like sometimes Josh makes the same pass as a teammate, and they're rapping Josh, but they're not rapping his teammate. And, you know, as I said, sometimes it's easy when it's someone else's kid, but an immense sense of pride of just what he's doing and where he's getting. And, you know, it's almost like he's made passing sexy again, you know, by what he's doing. And
you know, that sounds like a song. I think that's like a song, was that?
Sexy passing. Yeah. And it's funny because Lindsay talked about players, and one of the most important things that people misread is, can you make the people around you better? And Lindsay was a big advocate of that, and I think that's one of Josh's specialties.
I've got another question I want to ask, but let me first start and say I can hear, and I know you well, obviously, but, you know, speaking to you for last, whatever it's been, I can see why Josh is way he is, you know, like the way, you know, he's very humble, and you've just got to take complete credit with that, Wazza, and that's just an amazing thing. But I'm going to ask a question. When did it get to the stage where, my God, this thing's a circus? It gets to it. I know I've got friends that have got kids in the NBA. When did it get to that stage where you're like, holy God, we've got to make some serious big decisions?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a total circus. The tent's been set up and the bandstand's out there. But just the last 2 years is crazy, just how quickly it happened, you know, going to the NBA Global, to Adelaide, you know, not wanting to go to college. And, you know, as I tell a lot of people, he was in the unique situation coming from Australia, where our year 12 is 6 months, finishes 6 months earlier. He had the crossover with the NBL. So he was able to finish year 12, play a season of pro, and then be eligible for the NBA draft before he was actually eligible to play college. So, you know, it really started once he went to Adelaide, you know, when his rank started growing through the prospective blokes saying where he was going to get drafted at. And then that last 6 months was just absolutely all over the shop, you know, getting the agent before he went to Adelaide. So there was a big process building up to it. But, you know, I'd say the 2 years was crazy and the circus is nearly ready.
Yep. All right. Well, it's that time of the pod. What we do is, for our avid listeners, they would know. Wazza, what we do is we ask you, we're going to give you a name, and we just ask you to give us a one-word answer or a sentence or what that person is. And we're going to take it in turns. We've got a couple of names for you. I'm going to start it, and I'm going to go with the man. You've mentioned him so much, and I can just see how much it's pride. Lindsay Gaze.
Guru.
Nice. Yep.
Okay. I got one for you. This one's out of left field. Ray Gordon.
Great man off the court. Patriotic teammate on it. White line fever.
Can I just say, and we don't swear on this show, I was shit scared to play against that bloke.
Well,
that's as simple as it was.
He was great. He would try and psych people out. He was that crazy on the court that the people were, like you said, Brad, genuinely scared of him.
Yeah. Oh, I was shit scared of him. All right, I'm going to go next. Dave Simmons.
Ultimate teammate. You'd want him in the trenches with you.
Nice. Okay.
Brian Gorgian.
Crazy hairdo, always a Diet Coke in his hand. Loved beating his teams, but ultimate respect for the way he coaches and what he's done for basketball in Australia.
All right, one completely left field, Margaret Gaze.
Oh, Lindsay's right-hand man. Loved Margaret. Margaret was fantastic to me, always welcoming me. You know, I might have been one of her favourite players, but she's my secret girlfriend.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Yeah.
All right. Well, I brought him up earlier, a year too early. Mark Bradke.
One of my really good mates. Was a roommate for years. First bloke I saw when I arrived at the AIS back in 86. And absolute legend of Australian basketball and probably the greatest centre I've ever played with.
Yeah, great call. Wazza, look, we can't thank you enough. We could speak for hours. You have been so good, and it's just so great to hear where it started, where it's going, what's happening now. As I said before, you know, with Hannah and Josh, you can see why they are what they are, because they've been raised in an amazing family. And to hear you talk about it the way, you know, the pride in your kids is just fantastic. And, mate, you are a guru of our NBL. Certainly not spoken about enough, 449 games and two championships, but we cannot thank you enough for coming on, mate. We really appreciate it through this busy schedule of yours.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Brad. And Boddy, thanks very much for having me. And, hopefully it jolts a few memories, and it's a nice trip down memory lane there for a few others.
Good on you, mate.
Has been for us, that's for sure.
And to Sam McKinnon, we'll speak to you soon.
No worries. Thanks, guys.
What a legend Wozniacki is, eh? What a great thing. You know, like, there'd be people out there that obviously are new to basketball into a sense. And all when you think of Giddy, would think of Josh, right? No question. And rightly so, because of what he's doing. But, mate, he was a hell of a player, Josh. Warwick. He was a hell of a player.
I called him Warren one time. Like, what the hell was I thinking?
Yeah, but how good are they? You know,
well, that good, but Warwick was so notorious for passing, always passing the ball, and there's royal shows right around Australia that occur where, you know, produce and livestock are put on show, and then some side shows. There's a royal show, right? Well, we had a royal show here when Warwick was playing for the Melbourne Tigers, and they happened to be playing the 36ers here in that week. So I wrote a little piece saying that Warwick had gone to the royal show, and you know that three shots at the basket for. The Bucks that he started the attendant by passing it to him three times.
Oh, boom, boom. Now, I just love him. And, you know, like, you look at how grounded, and you even heard there from Wozner a couple of times where he was like, you know, the egos in the NBA and all of these things, where just how grounded Josh is. And that's the parents. You know, like, it's just so good. And it was interesting to hear about him coaching because, yes, I've got, you know, a 14-year-old son, a 12-year-old son.
Yeah.
You know, they're talented. I'm not going to lie. I don't know how far they'll go, but they're talented. And as a parent, you're like, oh, my God, what do I do? Do I coach? Don't I coach? Do I push in this
one? You have to because you know the game. It's as simple as that.
Still a lunatic. You know, this may shock you, but when I was coaching ABA and I was up in Newcastle and we had ABA – was the Comets, what I was coaching, versus Newcastle. And that was always the big one. And Dr. Adrian Hurley was their coach, right? So that was the big one. We were always in the grand finals together and stuff. Right. And there was a sign up in Newcastle. And I know this is going to shock you, don't fall over, where the coach is a caged monkey, is what I was called, right? Because I'm a lunatic on the sideline. I remember saying to Gorge one time, I'm not sure if you knew, but I was an assistant to Gorge.
No, I thought you were a Red Auerbach's assistant.
Yeah, right. And I remember saying to Gorge one time, mate, you know, like, I'm so nervous before games because I'm that guy. I wander up and down sidelines, you know. And he's like, Rosen, there's only two coaches. There's Lindsay Gaze, right, who sits there and do nothing. Then there's us. That's what he says to me, right? And then it's like, it was unbelievable. So
Phil Smythe must have been a Lindsay clone.
Because
Phil was pretty good. Yeah, sit back, hands behind the head. All the work's done at training. So now let him play. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Speaking of which, let's talk some NBL here. Chuck me your Rosen Rattler. Let's start from in a good place.
Well, I'm going to set this up and set the scene for the Rosen Rattler of how good some games have been, like the closeness of games. But I have not seen a game in a long time like that Sydney Kings Perth game. The game where it was on its own was Jalen Adams versus Bryce Cotton. The big shots that they did. So you're asking my Rosen Rattler? Mate, those guys were fun to watch. I was on the sideline and I am just saliva. You know, like, this is just great. And it wasn't, you know, like one of those games where it's close and, you know, teams miss four shots and then one guy rolls one in. This was three-point play. I got into a timeout and I'm listening to Coach Buford from the Kings, whatever you do, don't let them shoot threes. Next play, Jesse Wagstaff gets a three-point, scores the three and gets
and
back.
And the bonus.
Right, and then the Kings go down and then they step out of bounds and then they jump out of bounds. And it's like, this thing is unbelievable. So
tech foul. Yeah, it was a huge
finish. And then Bryce, you know, was just phenomenal because, let's be honest, I didn't think really, you know, others in that Perth didn't play amazing. There was good guys that played roles, but Bryce was just dagger, and then Jalen Adams and the three. Oh, mate, I loved it. That was the game of the year for me.
Yeah, but that's also the reason why I'm not completely sold on Sydney as a championship contender. I want to see how Ian Clark evolves over the next few weeks. If he's as good as what we expect, then yes. Yeah. But because they tried everything to lose that game, the last minute 18, 1 minute 18, they were 96, 89 up, 7 up. And they did, as you said, they did everything possible to try and lose it. I mean, accidentally.
It was a very poor finish. The things they did were, excuse the language, just dumb.
Yeah.
You know, you step out of bounds, you jump up or out of bounds, you foul a three-point shooter. You're right. You
foul on a rebound.
You can't afford to do that. It's a good point you make, yeah. But that was Rosen Rattler. I loved it.
It was a good one because I think Bryce and Jalen Adams, that was fabulous to watch. It really was.
All right, give me a nodge nasty.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound like a stuck record, but the hero ball has just given me the willies. You know, like we saw it a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned it, Scott Machado for Cairns against New Zealand, trying to go for the big hero play at the end of the game, which we know he's capable of making, but not when you've just come back off injury, your time's being managed, that's crazy. And then last week, this very game we've been talking about, The Perth Wildcats get the ball back with 23.6 seconds. Shot clock is turned off. They bring the ball up the floor. They're a point down. They just need to run some clock, get a good pick and roll situation for Bryce Cotton. He's going to hit a mid-range jump shot or take it to the hoop and draw a foul, or he's going to hit the roller. Something good's going to happen if you put the ball in Bryce's hands. So he gives it to Vic Law with 12 seconds left on the shot clock, Brad, 12. And Vic Law jacks one up from the frickin' Kmart sign. Like, what are you doing? And, of course, Sydney gets it back, goes down, Xavier Cooks throws down the dunk. Fabulous finish for the Kings, but I haven't seen Perth break down and run that dumb a play, that dumb a hero ball play, in as long as I can remember, to be completely honest. And then we've also got the Robert Franks one for the Brisbane Bullets against South East Melbourne, where he sort of pulled up and said, hey, I'm going to be the hero here. No, you're not. It's at zero. So it's a curiosity to me, and I want to throw this to you. Do you think that we are now in a situation where a lot of our imports think they're like the NBA players, like LeBron or something, at the end of the game, oh, I've got to take the shot? Because I think from a coaching perspective, I'd rather still run a good play that gets your best player open rather than just hand him the ball, everybody else ducks out, and we hope for the best.
Yes, I do. I agree with you. I do think that, and I don't think you just put it down to imports as well. Like, I looked at that South East Melbourne game where they played Melbourne. Now, I know there's some good players in that game, but you've got an NBA quality three-point shooter that took three shots for the game. Mm. Right, yeah. And then you look at it between Kyle Adnam, Liafa, and Tarangi. They shot 34 shots between them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that was 10 from 34, right? So to answer your question, I don't think it's just imports, mate. I just think it's that situation where, I mean, probably that's wrong with me. I wouldn't have dared done that.
No,
you know what I mean?
We've been whipped out so fast.
But I just wouldn't have been allowed because you run your plays, you run your sets. And I think that's a production of what this league is at the moment. Not many teams run sets. What teams do is they run, like, if you call it the shuffle or whatever you want to call it, where it's a continuous offense. Yeah. So you cut, you do this, you do that, and you're reading the defense. And I don't have a problem with that. But what that means when you read the defense is you get down to 3 or 4 seconds left. Holy shit, what do I do now? And a lot of those shots that Liatha did, certainly down the stretch, was like, well, I got to shoot this. Where back in our day, it's a down pick, it's a cross screen, it's then. And then if it breaks down, right now we're going to an on ball. But I do agree that was a 30-second shot clock, which made it easier.
Yeah.
That was a bad shot at the end of the game by Vic Law. That was a bad shot, and the others were as well.
Yeah. I mean, I look at Phoenix, and I think obviously everyone's got the green light to shoot the ball, but when the green is the colour of vomit, that's when you got to stop.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Ryan Brockhoff, how do you get three shots to him?
Yeah.
He's got to get the ball. And can I just say, 34 minutes. It wasn't like he played 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then he came out the next game and, sorry, I can't even remember who they beat the next one. But
Brad, wouldn't you have loved to have played 34 minutes? I mean, I reckon you'd
have... Do you mean in my career?
I'm not talking total. No, I'm saying, like, in a way, you think you would have got more than three shots up? Like, even as a role player, you would have got more than three shots up.
That's if I was crazy. If I was playing that, absolutely, because I'd get 10 layups. You know what I mean? Like, you're just... Yeah. But that's the... Because Southeast Melbourne are very designed where those guys go to the wings.
Yeah.
Right. They do go to the wings. And then point guard's trying to make a play and then it's like kick to the wing. So, Brokoff's not one of these guys that he's going to jack up. He's got to be open. So he's not going to take poor shots. So really interesting. Anyway, time to go, mate. Oh, yep. WNBL, talk to me. Anything stuck out?
No, I'm still at odds with the WNBL because I think if a team like the Canberra Capitals can be given the game against Sydney is a game that should have been taken off them. They get to play Southside when Southside have half their team away, and then they get to get a forfeit from Southside. So that's three wins that the Canberra Capitals have that is going to put them into the playoffs. And yeah, I just think that is a competition that has no integrity. I'm sorry, I'm out. And on that sad, sad note, I want to wish you adieu and see you next week.
Thanks, mate. Great to see you. To everyone, thanks for joining us, Piranha Media. Love having you on the board. And don't forget, we never want to forget our great friends at Burger Boss. See you next week, all.
Hey, you still there? You haven't cut it? Excellent. No. Great. Did you watch the front bar this week on Seven?
Oh, my God. How funny was that, buddy? That was fabulous. With Phil Smythe, obviously.
Absolutely, yeah. So if anyone who didn't see it, you can get it on 7+. Go there and have a look. It is a really good tribute to them and very funny. And their ripoff of The Last Dance, which is called The Last Comb Over, definitely worth seeing. Quick comment, though. Watch the program, not just the promo, because Luke Longley is asked seriously afterwards whether Phil Smythe in his peak would have been an NBA player. And he says absolutely he would have.